Inside Crime is brought to you by A Block Media, a full-service consulting firm specializing in media solutions for the law enforcement community. Law enforcement professionals know A Block is a partner they can trust. I'm Angeline Hartman. As a journalist, I've worked with cops and victims of crime all over the country. My craft is storytelling. My passion is crime fighting. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Inside Crime. I wanted to start off this week by saying a big thank you. Thank you to all of our listeners out there for being interested in learning about this mystery and for wanting to do more. As I mentioned before, this podcast is being produced in real time. We're not only bringing you the story about this unidentified child found in DeKalb County, Georgia, we're also fielding calls, tips, and suggestions that I'm passing along to investigators. If you're listening out there, you can be an active participant in this unsolved case by spreading the word about this podcast and by giving us your input. We've gotten incredible support from you, which has resulted in national media attention. That's exactly what investigators want. The more eyes on this case, the better.
When I saw that name, I'll never, ever forget that feeling. When I saw that Cadell Brown and Caleb Brown, and I found that on the list, I thought, you know, holy crap, this has got to be it.
The Cadell Brown lead intrigued investigators from the start. It turns out you're fascinated by this call, too. It's the number one lead that you're asking to know more about. In response to your requests, we're exploring this tip from the beginning.
In 1999, I was a homicide detective with the DeKalb County Police Department in the Major Felony Unit. I would go on to serve 21 years in law enforcement, retiring in 2015.
Chris Harvey was the lead detective for the case of the child in the woods.
One of the first things we did was get with the DeKalb County school system and talk with them about the type of data they could provide in terms of the students who had withdrawn or dropped out of the system or had, you know, anything unusual, reports that would sort of match the time frame that we thought we were looking at. At the same time, we also realized that, you know, we were not far from an interstate.
Not far from the interstate meant an easy getaway for the person who left this child behind. And detectives knew there were no guarantees that this child lived locally. The possibilities were endless.
You start pulling those threads, instead of unraveling it, it frankly turns into a bigger and bigger knot, and it's what if, what if, what if. And one of the dangers when you're looking at a problem like that is to be overwhelmed by it and say, well, there's too much to ask for. I can't ask for it. The other thing to keep in mind is that 20 years ago, we didn't have nearly the technology and the computer searchability and analysis that we have now. I mean, we got Xerox lists of students. You know, they didn't have Excel spreadsheets that you could sort and filter and notate very easily. It was very much an analog system with a yellow highlighter and a bunch of papers that were stapled together, where we went through and did everything we could to identify and account for all these kids.
As Chris talks about technological limitations, it's important to remember that two decades ago, the instant connectivity that we take for granted today was not available. And it was no different in police work.
You couldn't just call somebody during the day because they would, you know, they were either at home or they were at work. And if you didn't have a work number, you had to wait till they got home and they'd call you back. And it was just this mm-hmm. phone tag and this lack of instant reaching out and touching somebody. So,
yes.
So every contact took probably five times as long as it did now. You couldn't email. You couldn't, you know, emails were back in those days were almost considered like private. You wouldn't give out your email to somebody.
Right. This is all very, very good to point out, because it's easy for people to be, you know, critical now or just not even understand.
And it was just a very different kind of work than it is now.
For months, police followed leads all over the country and checked school records.
And we went through kind of one by one and identified and eliminated the kids we could. And that was kind of a constant process. And then, of course, we got the tip from the ME's office, the phone call they got about this this Cabell Brown, the Caleb Brown. And that kind of shook things open for me when we got that.
Remember, that Cabell Brown call came in October 1999. 8 months after the child was found. Here's an excerpt from episode 2.
She was already upset when I picked up the phone. Now, I don't know what the secretary heard, but when she transferred the call to me, I identified myself as a Jim Mabe, a forensic investigator with the medical examiner office. What can I do for you? And she was genuinely upset at the time that she made the phone call. And she said, you're like, oh my God, I know who this is.
Jim told me the woman called saying she recognized the child after seeing his image. It's unclear if she saw the little boy's face on the news or maybe a flyer, but she was certain that she knew him. She said his name was Cabell Brown, that his parents frequently visited Florida, and he went missing in 1999.
The initial call was probably 2 or 3 minutes. Until it was at that point I determined I just can't understand what you're saying. And it wasn't because she was so excited and just talking so fast that I couldn't understand it. It was just the noise, the background. She was upset, obviously, but not to the point of being incoherent.
That call, made from a phone at the Florida Institute of Technology, was eventually disconnected. But for the first time, investigators had a name. It sounded like Cabell Brown. Back at DeKalb Homicide, that name instantly rang a bell for the lead investigator.
Sometimes things just stick in my mind. And this name, Cabell Brown or Caleb Brown, for some reason, when I saw that on the tip sheet we got from the hotline, it instantly hit. I mean, it was like a you know, you hear the doing sound, mm-hmm. and it was like, I've seen that name before, and I've seen it somewhere. And I went back into the records that we have, and I found it on the list of that we got from DeKalb County School System. And I thought, and it was, there was a slight difference. It was either Cabell or Caleb or Caleb or Cabell with maybe one L or two L's or something like that. But I said, this is it. This is, I've seen this name, and here is the name. We need to find this kid. We need to figure out who this person is.
When police connected the dots, that lead took them to Florida, of all places. Did that mean the caller was right? Had a child named Cabell Brown moved to Florida? Was he the same child who had been pulled out of school in DeKalb County?
It's practically a one-to-one match. And I thought, wow, that can't be a coincidence.
Wow. And then what happens?
Well, as I recall, we got the FBI involved because we knew we were going to be dealing with Florida. And the information was passed up to them. I believe I spoke with an FBI agent and sort of explained what was going on. And they were going to send somebody out. And my memory is that I think the first reaction from the FBI was they had sort of made a tentative identification. I think they'd found the school that this child was supposed to have gone to, and they had confirmed with the administration that the kid was enrolled in the school and the kid was at school, but there had been some hesitancy to actually make contact with the child or make contact with the parents for some reason. I don't know if it had to do with PR or concern for privacy or not wanting to, you know, have the FBI agent engage a child at school. And I was a little bit concerned that they were just sort of taking the paper match and saying, well, we found this kid, he's in school, it's done.
Chris says he later heard that the FBI had circled back and determined the lead did not pan out. But now, 20 years later, He says he feels unsettled about that outcome.
I would have, you know, liked to have seen a report from the FBI that said, you know, Agent Jones went to this school at this time, made contact with this person. They were able to produce a birth certificate or some type of record that showed this Caleb Brown or Cabela Brown matched the person, matched the same records that were in the DeKalb County school system, and really trace it back down, because we had that was really the only thing we had. And that wasn't done, and we didn't follow up on it, and we basically took them at their what was reported back that they had done it, and maybe they did, and maybe it all would have matched, but looking back on it now, I wish I had been more insistent that we get records, and that I put my eyes on it, and that I confirm everything. The standard today is different than it was 20 years ago. You think back on shoulda, woulda, couldas, and I would have wanted and demanded some more documentation that I could have put my eyes on and said, I'm satisfied that this is a done deal.
Chris believes that now, two decades later, the Cabela Brown lead is something that should be reexamined. I asked Chris if, given the resources today, what he would do to investigate.
Data is the name of the game today with just about everything.
We wanted to take a closer look at the possibility of applying new technology to this 20-year-old case. So we spoke with an expert in data analysis.
So we have the name Cabela Brown, and we have the location, you know, somewhere in Florida.
Javier Melendez is an intelligence analyst for the Department of Defense. Javier's career has focused on identifying those who threaten our national security, terrorists, international drug traffickers, and transnational criminal organizations. He pores over large amounts of raw data, analyzing every bit of information to match a name, face, and location to those threats.
The simple way of explaining my job is that I find people that don't want to be found.
In short, Javier's job is to find a needle in a haystack.
So then let's take the sample of data of males, African American, born in the state of Georgia between the years 1990 to 1995. Mm-hmm. Right, I'm just picking a random round number.
Sure.
So that we can work with the data.
Let's
say there's 1 million males born between 1990 and 1995 that are African American, born in Georgia. Okay, that's a huge sample. Anyone that sees 1 million pieces of data is going to be quickly overwhelmed. So we can start narrowing this data down. Every male in this country, when they turn 18, they have to register for the Selective Service. Every male that made it to 18 drops off the list. Let's say we drop 750,000 names off our million off the bat. 750,000 males born between 90 and 95 signed up for the Selective Service. They are not our Dennis Doe.
Okay.
Now we have 250,000 names.
From there, he whittles it down by driver's license info, Medicaid records, tax, and school records.
All of a sudden, you've went from 1 million possibles to 10,000 probables.
Mm-hmm.
And that 10,000 amount is actually a really workable number. You know, using just open source data, you know, start Googling names, start looking through social media, start looking at college registrations. And, you know, anyone that didn't show up anywhere else will start dropping out. And you can actually get a fairly manageable number of leads to ultimately follow thoroughly. You know, say you have 100 names. Okay, let's work on 100 leads and let's start narrowing those down.
What Javier has explained is simply deductive analysis. Even though the data sets are large, current technology makes that analysis easier. Therefore, applying those techniques in this case could be very successful.
1999, you tell the detective that he needs to go through 1 million lines of data. There's a 0% chance that that he would want to do it. But now, you know, with the amount of computing power that's available, you know, even on your smartphone, your smartphone has enough technology to guide an Apollo rocket to the moon, apparently. So, you know, a million lines of data to find a person is not unreasonable.
Talking with Javier confirms what Chris Harvey suggested, that analyzing data with new tools might lead investigators to answers. There's also another scientific advancement making headlines a lot these days that might help.
We currently have six cases right now that we are pursuing genetic genealogy on, and we are very hopeful that we will be getting some very good results through the DNA so that we can do the genealogy searches.
Carol Schweitzer supervises the Forensic Services Unit at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. This team helps support law enforcement and medical examiners on cases of unidentified deceased children. Each case is unique.
We are looking at a case with a fresh pair of eyes, so we are doing everything from reviewing police files, medical examiner's files, providing guidance to law enforcement and the medical examiners on resources that we could help facilitate or apply today that might not have been available years ago when the case first came about.
And you might be surprised to know that the National Center is working on more than 700 cases. That's more than 700 children without a name.
We're doing a lot of work trying to identify emerging technologies that can be applied to these types of cases, such as isotopes and pollen and what everybody's hearing on the news these days with genetic genealogy. We're cultivating those resources and learning about them to be able to apply them appropriately to these cases.
Through genetic genealogy, investigators have been solving cold cases across the country, combining DNA evidence and traditional genealogy to find biological connections between people.
It's taking another old tool that people have used for centuries and with new DNA technologies, instead of writing down everybody's family histories and descendants, they're now using DNA to find each other. And now it's being applied very recently to forensic cases. And this is a brand new tool that investigators can use to help identify these unknown victims.
Can that be applied in this case, or do we know yet?
I don't think we know yet, but I think there's a really good chance that we will have some sufficient samples to test. But that's something that the investigators are looking into right now.
Can we find out the name of this child in DeKalb County after so many years?
Yes, I think it is a solvable case. I think they're all solvable. But you know, what's special about this little boy is that we know a couple things. We know that he was cared for. He was found wearing nice clothing. You know, he had good bones, there was nutrition and care, and he had good teeth. So somebody cared about this little boy, meaning that there's somebody out there that's looking for him, that remembers him, that hasn't forgotten about him. Somehow there's a link between this little boy and that area in Georgia where he was found. So I think there's a really good chance that there is somebody, I know there's somebody still out there that remembers him, and that's looking for him, and that's wondering where he is. Because we've seen that on every single case.
Investigators are now counting on you to help pull the pieces of this puzzle together. Share this podcast and help spread the word. And if you know any information about this little boy, please call the DeKalb County Medical Examiner's Office or the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children at 1-800-THE-LOST. Inside Crime is produced by A-Block Media. For more information about this episode, check out our website, insidecrime.com. Feel free to drop me an email, too. I would love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening. I'm your host, Angeline Hartman. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode of Inside Crime.